Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, talking with journalists in neighboring states, we'll see how the work of lawmakers in our surrounding states this session compares to what's going on here in Iowa. We'll travel to the legislatures in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, also Nebraska and South Dakota. But let's start with Missouri. Jason Rosenbaum is with me, politics correspondent with St. Louis Public Radio. Hello again, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us. In Missouri, the Republican Party controls everything, the offices of governor, secretary of state, attorney general, both chambers of the state legislature. You have a Republican governor, Mike Parson. What issues have been dominating this session?
There have been two issues in particular that have been top of mind over the last couple months. The first is an effort to make Missouri's constitution more difficult to amend. Unlike a lot of states, Missourians have the ability to enact constitutional amendments and statutes through the initiative petition process. And what Republican lawmakers want to do is change it from passing constitutional amendments by a majority vote to a majority vote and a majority of congressional districts. Now, there have been other attempts to do this in other Republican states like Arkansas and Ohio, and they have failed pretty miserably. And there is little secret that this is being done to try and stymie an abortion rights initiative that is trying to get enough signatures to legalize the procedure throughout the Show Me State. So it remains to be seen about whether that will get two voters, because changing the initiative petition process in Missouri will require a statewide vote, but that's something we'll be closely watching. Also, education is a big issue this session. There is an effort to expand what's known as educational savings accounts, which are basically bank accounts that people donate to. They get a tax credit, and then those accounts donate to students that can use the money for public or private schools of their choice. Those are the two main issues. Considering it's an election year, it's kind of surprising that there's any policy movement on things like education, but I guess this was a legislative session that was meant to exceed exceedingly low expectations.
Jason, I understand that the Republican school voucher program there in Missouri has seen criticism from the right.
Yeah, there has been some homeschooler criticism of this program, and it has created kind of unusual coalitions of opposition between homeschoolers who are very, very conservative and what I would classify as traditional supporters of public education in Missouri, which already has a pretty unique coalition of Democrats and rural lawmakers who often have superintendents who are particularly influential in their communities. But this bill got through the Senate and as I kind of mentioned, getting through the Missouri Senate is often seen as the most difficult thing in the Missouri General Assembly, simply because there is a strong filibuster in Missouri where somebody could stand up with allies and talk a bill to death. And the fact that that bill got through the Senate and is now in the House gives me a sense that even if there is opposition among homeschoolers, it may not be enough to stop it from going to Governor Parson's desk.
Mm-hmm. Any other bills aimed at transgender people, the LGBTQ folks?
Yes, there is a kind of nascent effort to try and change the state's ban on gender-affirming care for most minors. Last year, that was passed and signed into law, and by that I mean legislation that would bar minors from accessing things like hormone therapy or puberty blockers. There is a so-called grandfather clause in there that would allow somebody who is getting either of those things to continue to do that, although the real life application of that grandfather clause has been complicated by the fact that a lot of medical facilities have just stopped providing those types of treatments to minors altogether. And the legislation is aimed at maybe getting rid of that grandfather clause and also getting rid of the fact that that bill is only going to be in place for, I believe, a limited amount of time. I think it is 4 or 5 years. And lawmakers want to basically get rid of what the so-called sunset. But I don't know if there's really a lot of energy to actually follow through on that. That sunset and the grandfather clause were put into the bill as a compromise to get it through the process and in the Senate in particular. And any effort to go back on that compromise is going to engender a lot of opposition.
Here in Iowa, Jason, we've seen bills targeting specific books, libraries, and so forth. Any of that in Missouri?
I mean, libraries are basically managed on a local level here in Missouri. A lot of communities have library boards that are actually have elected positions in there. Some are appointed by the county officials. And I think that there are maybe some efforts locally to decide to remove books or not put books into libraries. But there hasn't really been like a particularly serious effort on a statewide level to do very much on that topic. Now, there are like state regulations that state that in order to get state library funds, you need to have basically a policy in place to allow parents to challenge certain books. But that is more aimed at that's mainly its strings attached to funding. That's not like a top-down state mandate telling libraries to ban certain books or not.
Yeah. With Republicans in control of all levels in Missouri, it sounds like there may be conflict within the Republican Party itself on several issues.
Yes, and I think that this has become kind of a running narrative in Missouri politics. Missouri used to be a much closer presidential and statewide place, especially in the 2000s and even in the early to mid 2010s. But it has become, much like Iowa, a very Republican state over the last 3 or 4 election cycles. And one of the downsides of being so dominant is in a particular state is if you have a belief that winning a primary is tantamount to election, then there's going to be a lot of factionalism and conflicts within the majority party. That happens in Democratic states too. I imagine that places like Massachusetts and Illinois and California have Democratic factionalism. But I think the difference is that even though Missouri is still like a Republican-leaning state, it's not like Wyoming. There's still lots of Democrats that live here. And I think there is kind of a subtle fear that this infighting could eventually hurt the party's presidential prospects. Whether it's in this upcoming election, though, kind of remains to be seen.
Yeah. Quickly, Jason, before we say goodbye, what do you watch? I'm not sure where you are in your session. What do you have your eyes on for the rest of it?
One of the things that I'm looking out for in particular is whether lawmakers seriously consider raising pay for child abuse investigators. In the St. Louis region in particular, there's been a pretty shocking backlog of unfinished child abuse and neglect claims because of high turnover in the state's children's division. And a lot of that has been attributed to the fact that child abuse investigators in Missouri are paid around $44,000 a year compared to over $70,000 in Illinois, and also pretty high compared to private sector opportunities. And there is a bipartisan contingent of lawmakers here who agree that the starting pay for child abuse investigators is just too low to compete with anything, and they want to do something. But the question is, like, how high do you raise it? Can you get buy-in from Governor Parson, who has typically shied away from targeted state employee pay increases. He prefers like a universal pay increase across state government. That's going to be something to watch, and it'll be interesting to see if that garners enough consensus to actually make it past the finish line.
Jason Rosenbaum, thank you so much for this quick flyover of your recent politics in Missouri. Jason is politics correspondent with St. Louis Public Radio. Take care, Jason.
Thank you.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we're checking in with State House journalists in surrounding states to see how the work of their lawmakers compares with what's been happening here in Iowa this session. Well, now let's swing up from our Republican neighbor in the South to our progressive neighbor in the North, to Minnesota, where the Democratic Party controls the offices of governor, secretary of state, attorney general, and both chambers of the state legislature. Democrat Tim Walz is the governor. And now to a voice familiar to us all, Clay Masters, now senior politics reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. So good to have you on, Clay.
Yeah, good to talk to you again, Ben.
So let's start with what issues have been dominating the legislative session up there?
Yeah, so last year was the first year that the Democrats in a long time had taken control of the trifecta, the inverse of what you have in Iowa, where the House, Senate, and the governor's office all have Democratic control. And they just, basically went nuts is how a lot of people have kind of explained it and how crazy the legislative session was in 2023, where they passed a lot of new funding for education, for a recreational cannabis program. There's a lot of just spending that went into last year. And now this is the second year of a two-year budget. We're in an election year. And so there's a lot of kind of there's an attempt to try to pass more supplemental spending this time around, but there's also the eyes on an election that's coming up in November, where both the House and the Senate hold very slim majorities. The House is up. All of the seats in the Minnesota House are up on the ballot again. And so Republicans are definitely trying to, point out the what they see as overspending that's happening in the state of Minnesota.
Clay, we have to take a short break. We'll be back to continue more in depth with what's happening in the Minnesota legislature. Clay Masters, senior politics reporter with Minnesota Public Radio, back in just a moment. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with more of River to River from IPR News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Our survey, our flyover of our neighboring states to find out what's happening in their legislative sessions. Let's continue my conversation with Clay Masters, senior politics reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. So, Clay, you laid out the priorities and set the scene there in Minnesota. Dig down into some of these issues that have been top of mind.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to, Iowa audience, they could probably find this as amusing as I do, being that it's the state that I've been covering the last 12 years. It's interesting to me that Governor Tim Walz in Minnesota, he actually held his, what they call the State of the State address last week, and the legislative session is halfway through. That's very much different than what we've seen in the state of Iowa, where the governor lays out their agenda at the beginning of the legislative session. And so Governor Tim Walz took center stage at a high school in southern Minnesota last week, where he talked about the accomplishments as he sees them that happened in the last legislative session in 2023, and kind of just stressed this keep on making as much progress as we can message with the House and Senate led by Democrats, and kind of just, saying that he doesn't know how long this window of opportunity that the Democrats will have, but committing to, do everything they can to, as he sees it, improve the lives of Minnesotans and leave the state better than they found it. So, Some of the things that are coming up this legislative session, there's been a lot of talk about an equal rights amendment that could get to voters in Minnesota in 2026 that would include protections for abortion and gender care. There's been a lot of discussion about school resource officers. There was a bill that was passed in the last legislative session in 2023 that Democrats needed to fix because of there were some challenges with what was written into the law when it came to school resource officers and what kind of holds and restraints they could put on students. And so the conversations right now have been largely kind of tweaking what laws had been passed in the last legislative session. And now that we have about 8 weeks left in the Minnesota legislative session, I think we're going to start seeing some more efforts to try to bring out new spending, new capital investment programs, because this is a bonding year in Minnesota. So there are a bunch of projects that they're going to try to get greenlit as we roll towards May.
Mm-hmm. I understand there may be some gun law changes there in Minnesota.
Yeah, that's right. And in the governor's State of the State address last week, he didn't really lay out any new proposals that he wanted the Minnesota legislature to take a look at. But he did say, as you mentioned, guns were there. The leaders of both the House and the Senate have said they expected a proposed gun restrictions. Walls would have a path toward the legislature this year. And this would have to do with straw purchases in the state of Minnesota and really trying to crack down on people and who can get firearms. And there was actually a shooting of three first responders were killed in a suburb south of the Twin Cities earlier this year. And it's put a lot of emphasis, a lot of discussion on gun laws in the state of Minnesota. And we are seeing a little bit of bipartisanship from the Republicans and Democrats in the state of Minnesota on how they're addressing guns. But there will be some differences as we see this legislation move forward.
Clay, with your perspective, having covered Iowa politics for so long and having school-aged children, I wonder, how do you compare the policies in Iowa's education with what you're experiencing there in Minnesota? Of course, in Iowa, private school vouchers passing recently.
Yeah, there definitely aren't the school voucher discussions happening in the state of Minnesota. And really, the kind of the conversation I think we're going to see when the election rolls around from the state office holders, from the House of Representatives and some of the more suburban districts are going to be discussions about how much spending is being put towards education and not seeing the kind of results that Republicans think there should be. There are conversations going forward just about how much the level of spending for education in the state of Minnesota, how much of a, you know, bang for their buck that that test scores and these kinds of things are getting. And so it's very much a different kind of discussion that's happening in the state of Minnesota than the state of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Clay Masters, senior politics reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. We miss you, Clay, but good to have you in our Midwest neighborhood. Thank you. And we hope we can check back with you again in the future.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ben.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, a quick survey of state house politics in neighboring states, courtesy of journalists who cover that beat in our neighboring states here in the Midwest. Let's put the spotlight on Illinois now. Of course, a Democratic stronghold and one of the so-called big three Democratic states alongside California and New York. Geographically in Illinois, Republicans cover more ground, but the Democrats have a supermajority. Both chambers of the state legislature are controlled by the Democrats, and their governor is Democrat J.B. Pritzker. Jennifer Fuller joins us now, managing editor with Capital News Illinois. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
We talked with Clay Masters in Minnesota just a moment ago about how they are looking into reproductive rights, protecting abortion rights there. I remember in Illinois, last time we spoke with someone in Illinois, that Illinois was working on protecting abortion care as well. Is that a thing of the past, or is that of the current legislation as well?
You know, I think I would call it a current issue, but more in terms of taking a closer look at the laws and rules that are in place now and making sure that they continue to provide the reproductive freedoms that Governor J.B. Pritzker and the Democratic legislature has made a priority for the last several years. Even before the Dobbs decision, which was coming up on now 2 years ago, Illinois lawmakers were looking ahead and saying, this is something we want to make sure is a priority. They have, in many cases, put Illinois on the map again in terms of standing out in the Midwest. The things that are allowed in terms of reproductive care in Illinois are not allowed in most of the neighboring states.
Mm-hmm. And so you have people traveling from neighboring states to Illinois for reproductive health reasons.
This is true in various parts of the state, particularly in the southern part of the state. We're seeing a lot more clinics open up because of increased demand and, in some cases, exponential increased demand.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, what have been some of the other highlights in your legislative session in Illinois so far?
Well, I like to tell people, even though we're halfway through the session for this year, it's still relatively early. Things don't pick up until late April, early May. Lawmakers get a lot of their work done in that last 4 to 6 weeks. So we're really starting to come into that really busy time. We have deadlines for legislation to get out of committee. The Senate has already had that deadline. The House has it here this week. So we'll be watching. This really kind of sets the tone for what the rest of session is going to look like. And we're still looking at some of those same issues, particularly on social levels. So perhaps you and your listeners have read about the migrant crisis and people being bused and flown Yes. to cities like Chicago. So there's legislation that addresses that, that addresses things like homelessness, like taking care of children who are now entering public schools in Illinois, but really need a little bit of a leg up or perhaps a hand up when it comes to making sure they're at grade level, hiring more teachers, things like that. But you've also got those traditional things that we're always looking at in cases of a budget, education funding. Illinois has pension funding that it needs to address, as well as healthcare and other issues.
I understand the governor is also focused on green transportation and energy.
Yes, that's true. And there was a lot of big legislation over the last couple of years to really set some goals and put priorities in place to make sure that the number of electric vehicles on the road increases in Illinois. But they're now starting to look at what the infrastructure needs to look like to make sure those EVs can get from point A to point B. So where are charging stations being put? How can there be incentives for private companies to install charging stations and make sure that those travelers can get from where they started to where they need to get to?
Mm-hmm. When we look at some of the laws being passed that are 180-degree difference from what we have here in Iowa, talk about what Illinois has passed, and I'm not sure this session, but I know in last year, school libraries and the banning of books, right? What have been the laws passed there, and have there been any subsequent laws?
Sure. So championed by the Illinois Secretary of State, who is also the state librarian, his name is Alexi Janulius, there is a law that says if a public library, whether it's a school library or a community library, that sort of thing, moves to ban books, and for the most part, that list is the one accepted by the National Librarian Association groups. If that happens, then those libraries are at risk of losing their state funding, which would be a big hit for a lot of those libraries. We've not seen any testing of that rule yet. You know, you hear anecdotally that, you know, this library board is voting to do something, but it hasn't yet escalated to the point where we've seen a library lose its funding. But it certainly garnered a lot of headlines. That bill passed into law last year. And I think that that's still something that state lawmakers and others are really keeping a close eye on. You know, who wants to be the first to challenge this, or how do we make sure that people are able to access the kinds of information that they need when they need it.
Mm-hmm. Guaranteed income, that is something that Iowa and Illinois also working on in different directions. Iowa lawmakers this session moving to ban guaranteed income programs. What's happening in Illinois?
There are several proposals that are being talked about. We had some what are called subject matter hearings on progressive proposals like that, like a guaranteed income. They're not moving anywhere just yet. That's not to say that they won't, but these were subject matter hearings where they talked about $1,000 a month, for example, for certain Illinoisans. That includes parents, people who have either recently given birth or adopted children, something to just kind of get them through the difficult time, you know, when you may not be able to work full time or you may not be able to pay those bills as you were. It's still in the idea stage. There's still a lot of talking about this. And the state's budget situation is really going to play a big role on whether something like that could continue.
Okay, Jennifer, before we say goodbye, anything big that we left out, or perhaps you'd like to tell us what you have your eyes on, especially for the rest of this session?
All eyes at the end of session are always on the budget. There are a lot of policy issues that are shaped because of that budget. This year, the revenue estimates are a little bit tighter than they have been in years past. So we're really taking a close look at, are there programs that are going to see cuts? Are there others that won't see expansions to the level that perhaps they thought they would get? So that's really what we keep a close eye on for those last several weeks.
Jennifer Fuller, so glad you could join us, managing editor with Capital News Illinois. Thank you, Jennifer. Have a great day.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, the day after Easter, we are hopping around the Midwest to check in with Statehouse journalists in our neighboring states, getting a sense of how their legislative work compares with what's been happening here in Iowa. Let's jump over to the Mount Rushmore state, South Dakota. Mackenzie Huber is with us. Mackenzie is the politics and public policy reporter with South Dakota Searchlight. Hi, Mackenzie.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being on. The Republican Party in your state currently holds majorities in both houses of the South Dakota legislature. Your governor is Republican Kristi Noem. I understand your legislative session started in January and has already ended.
Yeah, we are all finished. We were finished with the regular session the first week of March, and we had our veto day on at the end of March, and no vetoes to be had. So it was a pretty chill session this year.
Okay, in this pretty chill session, what would you say were the highlights?
The highlights this year, I would say it was definitely education focused. That was mostly where a lot of legislators were concerned. There was also a lot of discussion and about pipelines and landowner rights. We also had some coverage of prison funding and long-term care funding, some county funding concerns, and then a little bit more judicial coverage as well. So,
let me ask you to dig into a few of those on the education front. I understand you had a educational savings account bill proposed, a school voucher program proposed. What happened there?
So the educational savings account, I believe it was actually called an educational empowerment account. I'm not quite sure. I don't really remember what it was called, but yes, we did have an ESA bill that was proposed. It died in committee because it costs too much. South Dakota wasn't ready to look at what that would do to schools, either private or public, since it would put a lot of money toward homeschooling or alternative education. The other bill that you mentioned, the school voucher program. South Dakota doesn't actually have a school voucher program. What critics call it is they call it a backdoors voucher program, where it's a tax incentive where I believe it's insurance companies can put money toward a sort of scholarship fund for private schools for people to use. They increased the cap this year because there was such demand for that program. So they increased that, but we do not have an official voucher program.
Here in Iowa, Mackenzie, we just had a bill passed and signed into law that raises the minimum wage for teacher pay across our state. That's been a focus in your legislature as well, teacher pay?
Yeah, that was a big focus this year ahead of session. Governor Kristi Noem, during her budget address in December, called on the legislature and school districts across South Dakota and the Department of Education to figure out teacher pay, basically to improve South Dakota's standing. We're 49th in the nation for average teacher salary. So part of that was a bill that several different legislators and education lobbyists kind of tackled together on a compromise to deal with that. So we have a minimum teacher salary now. We didn't have one before. It's at $45,000 statewide. And we have another metric that we're hoping to track is the average teacher compensation. So that's both salary and benefits. And that goes by district, and those districts are supposed to increase that compensation every year, as well as the minimum salary every year, tied to legislative increases in state funding to education. So this year we got a 4% raise for education funding. That would mean next year. That's not how it actually works, but if there was a 4% raise, it would increase by 4%. That 45,000 minimum salary would increase by 4%, as would district specific compensation.
We have to take a short break. We'll be back with more of our survey of legislatures around the Midwest, our surrounding states. Back to more with Mackenzie Huber of South Dakota in just a moment. It's River to River from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back with more River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our survey of legislatures surrounding Iowa continues. Let's get back to my conversation with journalist Mackenzie Huber of South Dakota. Mackenzie, you mentioned concerns about pipelines, and Summit is something that South Dakotans know about, too, as they do here in Iowa, the pipeline project. Tell us more about what's been happening there in terms of legislation.
Yeah, so there were more efforts by some legislators to ban the use of eminent domain for the carbon capture pipelines. That failed again this year. But what did happen is there was a package of bills dubbed sort of a landowner bill of rights package, especially to one of the bills that kind of set into place some protections or some ways for landowners and counties to be compensated if these pipelines come through, or to protect them if they come through. It still opens the door to the pipeline conversation, and to have that that pipeline come through, especially since Summit is going to reapply for the pipeline being built in South Dakota. So there's still some controversy over whether or not it does anything for landowners to protect them. But yeah, that package of bills did pass, and Kristi Noem did sign that. So,
what have you seen in South Dakota in terms of bills targeting specific books or libraries? We've seen that here in Iowa.
We had that last year, but we didn't have that this year. So this year, what the legislature sort of agreed on was that they would have this bill that would sort of require both schools and public libraries to have a policy, first of all, for book removal or content that parents didn't want their child reading, whatever it may be. concerning sort of that that oversight of material. And so they're requiring those entities to have a policy and to post that policy on their website or in a place that's accessible. So that was the only bill concerning book bans that was introduced in the legislature this year, and that made it through. There wasn't a lot of pushback from it, since it was sort of everyone agreed that they would do something, and this is the something.
In reading about South Dakota, I see there is a bill to make drunk drivers responsible for child support if a parent is killed in a crash.
Yes, so that did pass through the legislature, and it was signed by the governor. That was part of sort of a national movement, I believe, to introduce this as a bill.
And finally, Mackenzie, I have to ask you about your governor, Kristi Noem. She's received quite a bit of national attention. She can often be seen on Newsmax, Fox News, other right-wing outlets, seemingly openly campaigning for the job of Donald Trump's vice president. How is that shaping your politics?
There's a lot of attention on it in South Dakota. There was people talking about whether the lieutenant governor would take over if she was selected as the vice president candidate, which South Dakota law does not make it so she would have to step down. She said she would still be governor if she is chosen, but there's conversation about it, surely. And Governor Noem has talked about it. She's been asked about it a couple of times now, and she said she doesn't really, she has been approached by it, but she said she's going to do whatever it takes to have Donald Trump be reelected to the White House. So she's open to being vice president, it sounds like, but she's also okay with not being vice president. So,
very good. Mackenzie Huber, thank you very much for your time and your expertise, politics and public policy reporter with South Dakota Searchlight. Take care, Mackenzie.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's continue our quick survey of legislative work this session in Midwest states surrounding our state. Now, according to Ballotpedia, in state governments across these United States, one of those is Wisconsin, where the Democratic Party controls the offices of the governor. Tony Evers is the Democratic governor, also the attorney general, while the Republican Party controls both chambers of the state legislature. Joining us once again, Anya Van Wankton Donk is the Capitol reporter with Wisconsin Public Radio, based in Madison. Hi, Anya.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. In Wisconsin, your lawmakers have adjourned for the year. What issues have dominated the session?
Yeah, this was actually a really significant session. We had some of the most significant bipartisan agreements here in a number of years, most significant of which is probably the passing of new legislative maps. It was the first bipartisan deal on legislative maps in more than 50 years. We also saw bipartisan agreement on a shift to how the state government funds local communities, which might sound very wonky, but was a really significant change, especially for rural communities and our major population center of Milwaukee. And we also saw a major bipartisan deal about funding where the Brewers play. And so those are some of the really big changes this year.
When you talk about new legislative maps and bipartisan, do the new maps give one major party an advantage over the other? How does that look?
For the last about 15 years, Republicans have had an outsized majority here, in part because of maps that were passed in 2009. And in December of this past year, our Supreme Court overturned those maps and basically said new ones need to be drawn up. And so that set the clock on a number of different parties submitting new maps. The ones that were ultimately approved were drawn by, as you mentioned, Democratic Governor Tony Evers, and then approved by the Republican legislature. So they still do favor Republicans, in part just because that is how the population of Wisconsin spreads out, but it gives them less of an advantage in that way. And Democrats sound pretty hopeful that they will begin to pick up some seats in places that perhaps should be, from a population level, competitive, but haven't been historically because of the way that the maps are drawn.
Does that have implications for this election year, with Wisconsin being a swing state?
Yeah, so there will be a number of legislative elections taking place later this year, and so we'll see kind of how that plays out. I think the longer term ramifications of what that looks like in the legislature, we won't start to see until the legislature comes back into session next January. So in terms of kind of how our national election plays out in November, I don't know that there will be a lot of significance there, but we'll see. You know, anything can happen. We certainly saw that in 2020. Anything can happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, increasingly across the country and here in the Midwest, states have been giving the thumbs up to recreational marijuana. Not so in your state, Anya.
Not so in Wisconsin. That's correct. We have neither recreational nor medicinal marijuana available here.
Mm-hmm. And has there been much debate around that?
There has been. And actually, this is another area where there is some bipartisan agreement, just not at the level of leadership necessarily. So the Republican leaders in the legislature are pretty firmly opposed to marijuana legalization in kind of any form. And so there's been a lot of discussion, and there was a bill proposed in the assembly this year that would have established a very small state-run medical program. There would have been, I believe it was something like 6 state-run medical dispensaries. And even that could not make it forward to a vote and did not have approval in the Senate. And so that's sort of the closest that we've come in my tenure here. And that's not very close at all.
Mm-hmm. Here in Iowa, the past two legislative sessions, our Republican lawmakers focusing on changes to our election laws. What about there in Wisconsin?
Yeah, this is, of course, a really significant issue here as well, as one of, I would say, the last true 50-50 swing states. So we have on Tuesday is our presidential primary, and we have 2 constitutional amendments coming up that would affect election law. One of them, in particular, coming out of 2020, would bar the use of private monies in elections. So that's a response to what were called Zuckerbucks grants from an organization funded and started by Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. So that's a direct kind of reflection of 2020. We also, in the last weeks of session, passed a bipartisan rule about protecting election workers. So it makes election workers a more protected class when it comes to assault or harassment or intimidation, and prevents doxing practices. So there's a little bit of that focus on what came out of 2020. And then we also have some court cases that are trying to determine some rules as well. There was a change to the rule around absentee ballot drop boxes. Those were banned in 2022 as a result of some of the contesting of the 2020 election. And that is now being reconsidered. And so we're still figuring out whether we'll have drop boxes in November.
Anya, I'm curious about a bipartisan bill you have there in Wisconsin creating a task force on missing and murdered African-American women and girls.
That's right. Yeah, this is a kind of interesting glimpse into some of the best and worst of how, you know, legislative democracy can sometimes function. This is very much a bipartisan bill. Typically, the way that a law moves forward or a bill moves forward here in Wisconsin, I should say, is that it needs to be authored by Republicans to really get a position on the floor. If it is just a Democratic priority, it's just not going to be taken up in that way. And this was authored by a Democrat, but really supported by her friends across the aisle. When I spoke to, you know, Republicans who backed her up on this, what they said was, we do this because we love her. So it was really a deeply personal issue for this one lawmaker, Representative Sheila Stubbs, and then backed up by her friends across the aisle and in her own party too, of course. And so it was passed in the assembly and then held up in committee in the Senate, according to some sort of technicalities around the committee function is sort of the official reason. And then, of course, what, you know, people tell me on background is that it was also a matter of kind of some personal issues with the idea of designating resources to just one community. I will note that we do have a task force on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And so this would have been sort of similar. And also the rates of missing and murdered African-American women here in Wisconsin do outpace other ethnic and racial groups. And so that's sort of the argument for having that kind of focus. But at the last minute, it just didn't get taken up to the floor for a vote in the Senate. And so it did not pass this year. Representative Stubbs, who I mentioned, says she will be bringing it back. But in the meantime, this very bipartisan bill just couldn't move forward.
Anya Van Wagten-Donk is Capitol reporter with Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Always nice to chat with you, Anya, about your session, which has adjourned for the year. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's finish up our quick survey of legislative activity in surrounding states by checking with our neighbor to the west, Nebraska, where the Republican Party controls the upper chamber of the state legislature. It has only one chamber. This is the only state in the nation that has only one chamber of their legislature. Republican Jim Pillen is the governor in Nebraska. Brian Beach joins us now, reporter with Nebraska Public Media News. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on. I understand you have a couple weeks left of your legislative session there. What has been the focus of this session?
Well, unlike last year's session, in which there was really one primary focus in a bill targeting gender-affirming care for minors and abortion, this session there have been a wide variety of debates. Taxes have been a major issue, and then also several bills dealing with obscenity, whether that's obscenity in school libraries or obscenity online on porn websites. So that's kind of really been, those have been the main driving themes of this year's legislative session.
Well, talk more about the obscenity bills out there, because here in Iowa, we've had bills targeting specific books and libraries. What is the character of the debate there in Nebraska?
Well, there are a lot of conservative senators, and I say conservative because actually the Nebraska legislature is officially nonpartisan. So even though you can kind of tell who are the Republicans and who are the Democrats, it's officially nonpartisan. There's no minority and majority leaders doing debate. So a lot of conservative senators, though, have brought forth bills aimed at getting rid of obscene books in schools, or really more accurately, eliminating a provision for teachers and librarians who have a legal defense against a charge brought against them for providing obscene materials in schools. And so you have a lot of the conservatives that are advocating for these bills, and some of the more progressive members have claimed that this could result in a chilling effect on teachers and librarians who, even if they're not officially banning books through this legislation, it would maybe be a little bit more intimidating for them to select more controversial titles. The official legal definition of obscenity is a lot more strict, but the concern is that people will bring lawsuits against these teachers and librarians for books they simply don't like or have issues with. And so that's really been the primary thrust of the debate so far.
Mm-hmm. What about bills allowing private school students to use tax dollars for private school?
Yeah, so in last year's session, there was a bill that was passed that would allow Nebraskans to take tax credits, a dollar-to-dollar tax credit, for donations to scholarship-granting organizations for private schools. And that was fairly controversial. In fact, so controversial, there's now a ballot initiative that was successful. It's going to be on the ballot in November for Nebraska voters that can repeal that scholarship, or those, it was called the Opportunity Scholarships Act. But also, meanwhile, in the legislature this year, there's another bill that would, instead of just providing tax credits, it would directly fund these scholarship-granting organizations with up to $25 million. So that bill hasn't necessarily gone anywhere yet in the legislature, and I think a lot of the further motion on this topic will just be a wait and see as to how this initiative, this ballot initiative, whether it passes or fails in November. But that's very much been at the forefront of the minds of voters and legislators going forward.
Joining us from the Cornhusker State, Brian Beach, reporter with Nebraska Public Media News. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you.
And that does it for today. Tomorrow on this program, we'll dedicate the hour to our spring severe weather season and ask such questions as, how is our weird winter weather, likely to affect the chances for severe weather. Also, what about the impact of our changing climate? Questions we'll dig into tomorrow on this program. Today's program produced by Samantha McIntosh. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.